Welcome to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by our show sponsor, Explorer Risk Medical. Explorer offer unique CPD adventures for paramedics, nurses, and doctors. You can learn about altitude, dive, tropical, or remote medicine whilst exploring some of the most picturesque locations in the world. So if you want to take your CPD out of the classroom and on an adventure, head to their website, www.explorerriskmedical.org.
So apparently we're not doing the official introductions anymore because Nick didn't like it.
I just want to mix things up.
We can do that, but you know, we've got a really good guest today, and I'm really excited about this one because he's a paramedic all-star.
All-star.
All-star. He's changing the way we're going to practice.
Has he been inducted into the Hall of Fame?
If there was a Hall of Fame, I reckon. Actually, how are we going to
get the Shift Extension Hall of Fame?
Number one. G'day, Matt. How are you?
Oh, man. I'm reeling. Thanks, guys.
Now, we did warn you that it's a casual podcast. We don't like much structure here. We like to just see where the conversations take us. But, mate, we met some years ago in paramedic circles. I think you had the displeasure of having to listen to me speak at a conference, came up and spoke after.
Yeah. Is that where we actually met? I was trying to remember that.
Long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have the somewhat dubious honour of being the person who pushed me into research, for which I'm deeply grateful,
Pushed?
I had no idea. But he certainly superseded me now, so he's...
Well, I'm glad. However, that happened.
Yeah, I remember this vividly. I got an email out of the blue from Sonny. He'd was nominating me to apply for this funding for this research thing. And I read it, and it was just like, you know, this incredible, incredible thing with these amazing people doing all kinds of weird medical research.
And it was huge.
It was huge, yeah. And I wrote back to Sonny, and I said, oh, mate, like, you know, I'm really flattered. That's very kind of you. I'm very grateful, but... I'm not cut out for this. I'm just a very average regular dude. And shortly after, Sonny wrote back, and the email popped up, and I opened it, and all it said was, apply.
This is an email from Sonny.
From Sonny, and nothing else. And
well, let's fast forward. You got it.
Yeah. Some kind of clerical error or something. I mean, I don't know who buggered up that one, but they gave it to me. So thank you very much.
But you've been influencing different aspects of paramedic research since you started. And one of the more exciting things that we certainly been on the peripheries of is your research into clinical guidelines. And that's what we're going to be discussing mostly today. The Clinical Guideline Manifesto was actually published last week, Nick, in a special edition. I think it was Volume 7, and it was made up of a series of posters that Matt and his team had actually put together. And it's created a lot of discussion and a lot of questions around clinical guidelines, because what are they? This is a question that a lot of people, although they've been bound by them, aren't even aware of the definitions that guide what they can and can't do. So, you know, getting Matt on here today to even talk about delving into this topic is hugely exciting. But Matt, what is a clinical guideline?
Oh, God, I should have prepared for that one.
No, it's going to come from nowhere.
The guidelines are basically these set of documents. They're mostly a historic thing from back when, way, way back in the days when ambulances were just a transport brigade. We didn't do any medical treatment. It was just to pick them up, take them to the pros in the hospital, through to, okay, we're going to start introducing some really basic skills, but we'll just teach people how to do the skills and nothing else, through to slowly introducing, teaching into the actual pathologies themselves, the reasoning, understanding what's going on so you can really provide a person with holistic care. And along with that, we've had documents which originally started off as if you see X, do Y, just really clear little protocols on what to do, which were completely appropriate at that time for that level. And over time, they've slowly evolved with the profession into being ultimately what we're calling guidelines in most places these days, where they give you a neat, handy, hopefully, you know, 1 to 2 page summary of a particular pathology and the main treatments behind it. And it's just something which you can use to help you make sure you don't forget the basics is most of the time how I'm using them. I think that's probably where we're at, more or less.
You mentioned the infancy was around the production of protocols per se, and there's still a lot of places around the world that utilize protocols. For our listeners, what's the difference between a protocol and a guideline?
Yeah, this was actually a fun story, tested in court recently. But a protocol is something you have to follow. A guideline is something which just gives you advice, which you can take or ignore as you see fit. Mm. So the important difference for a paramedic there would be if you're working underneath a protocol, you have to follow it. And if you don't, you're essentially breaking the rules of your organization. If you have a guideline, you can take into account a million different things way beyond just what's written in that document. All the other things you might have studied or learned and practiced in your spare time, all of that comes into informing how you're going to treat that particular patient. And that's incredibly, incredibly important, in my opinion. I mean, I'm just a standard run-of-the-mill paramedic, but I've gone outside my guidelines, I think, about three times this year alone. Once was for a severe asymptomatic hypertension. We had a lady whose blood pressure was like 205 and we were an hour from hospital. So rather than do nothing, there was no guideline in my service for that. I jumped on the phone and rang someone up and said, hey, I'd like to give just 2.5 morphine to reduce that sympathetic drive and kind of gently ease them down in line. There's particular blood pressure targets. You have to do it very slowly. And on the phone, they said, hey, that's great, but I want you to do something a bit different and add in 2.5 midazolam as well. And then call me back in 20 minutes. And we'll see how they're going. And if I was functioning under protocols, that wouldn't have been possible. I wouldn't have been able to give that patient their best treatment. It would have just been a blanket drive them to hospital and let someone else deal with it. So having these guidelines, we are able to use them, but not to be bound by them, is an incredibly powerful thing.
Can I ask, I mean, you know, we talked about that these are a historical thing that have obviously come from the beginning of time when paramedicine was in its infancy. And I mean, look, yes, we're now nationally registered within Australia. New Zealand have also followed suit. I think it's one of the only times that they followed us. Normally it's us follow them. That's controversial. Going to upset a few people. But where do these come from? Who dictates what you can and can't do as a paramedic? These are the questions that they seem to have some vague responses and some varying responses based on the different states and state lines that we exist around.
It varies depending on where in the world you're looking. Do the people who listen to this podcast, are they all Aussies or are we looking at them?
No, it's about 65% Australian.
Oh, really?
So the other ones come from predominantly Great Britain, New Zealand, Canada, the US, and South Africa, and a little bit of Zimbabwe, apparently.
No way. Yeah. God, I love South Africa. It's just great. Well, the people in the UK will know better than I do. They have JR Calc, a kind of national body who writes a single set of guidelines which each of the local individual services, NHS trusts, can then vary their local practice from. So they have this centralised body with the ability to twist and turn it as you need. In New Zealand, it's all a single set of guidelines, which is used by both the jurisdictional services but also some of the major private providers, like our own medical providers. They run under those as well, and they all come together and write them together. The US, I'm not 100% sure. From what I understand, most places over there, paramedics don't have their own authority to practice. It's like derived from a doctor. So each service has a doctor who writes the guidelines about what they're happy for the people in their service to do. That could be totally wrong.
It still sounds similar to the setup here in the UK. It's still doctors writing guidelines.
Sometimes. I mean, sometimes not. You know, New South Wales Ambulance went through, I think, about a two-year period where they didn't have a medical director because they didn't need one.
And so who sits in their place?
Paramedics.
So is this where we start coining things like...
I should say they did actually bring one back in because they saw a great deal of benefit in having a medical director in the service, but don't have to have one.
So is this where you see things like the paramedic consultant role? Is this...
Definitely.
What authority would a paramedic consultant have, though, to dictate guidelines in a national healthcare system? The reason I ask this is because we're speaking at the moment largely around jurisdictional services.
Yeah.
So the state-owned ambulance services and most, if not all of those, have got medical directors since the beginning of time who then dictate what can and can't happen because there's a difference in state laws. There's a difference in drug availability and there's a difference in culture. That can influence these things. But it seems that although we have a national registration body for paramedics in Australia to, you know, attempt to professionalise the part of healthcare that we are delivering care through, there's still a heavy reliant on the need for medicine because we can't access the things that potentially we're doing.
Mm.
Where does that leave someone like a paramedic consultant?
It's a great question. We'll have to see what happens over the coming decades, probably, hopefully not quite that long. as they do it. I mean, when you're working for one of these jurisdictional services, you really basically have two kind of, obligations that dictate your treatment. One is the really broad one of doing something that's within good medical practice, and that's really what our regulator, APRA, will step in and enforce. They only get involved when there's safety concerns. So they're less concerned about whether treatment was optimal or maybe not quite optimal, but okay. They're just wanting to know, is it safe or is it unsafe? And that's where they get involved. Within each of the services, they then have the ability to dictate how their employees practice. That's something which any employer can do. You say, as an employee, you're allowed to do X, you're not allowed to do Y. And that's really where the guidelines come from. They come from the individual services, and they really function to kind of, impose some kind of soft limits around the outside of stuff that paramedics can and can't do, so we don't have people doing completely wild, crazy things.
So you might see some variations from state to state based on what they believe their staff should be doing, how they should be caring for patients, but as long as it's reasonable and within good medical practice, then they're happy with that?
More or less. I mean, the variations between states can be massive, just absolutely huge. And often there's pretty good reasons for that. The ambulance services want to integrate with the wider healthcare system. We don't want to be off doing our own thing. So if your local ED is using a particular drug, it might make really good sense for you to use that drug within the ambulance service as well, even if that drug is maybe the second best in terms of out-of-hospital evidence or something like that. So there's lots and lots of little nuances and reasons as to why these variations exist between services. And having a variation isn't necessarily of itself a bad thing. It's really looking at the evidence and weighing up a lot of different factors to say, is that good? Is that what's best for our patient?
Speaking of variations, it's no secret that across Australia, paramedics are practicing differently. And all of us, unless we've moved into state regularly, are fairly siloed into one system of belief. And this is where a lot of the rivalry comes from too. But I'm curious to know almost what was the reason, or what was that spark? What happened for you that actually even made you start to review these? Because you've essentially published one of the only existing comparisons of what our paramedics are doing in Australia. It would be the most recent, and it is the only one that's been published in such a visually friendly way that you can literally have you seen the posters, great. Nick?
Yeah, fantastic.
You can literally just map exactly what your service is.
I like to use that as my selling point, because I think there's at least 6 or 8 formal academic comparisons that I'm aware of for different topics, you know, obstetrics and arrest and stuff like that. But I always like to say, but hey, these ones are neat little posters.
And it's a fairly comprehensive collection. Correct me if I'm wrong, there's 33 comparisons, is that correct?
Yeah, we basically just went, looked at, there was an existing document which had categorized how many services had guidelines on particular topics. So we used that, started at the most popular, the ones which existed in the most service, then kind of worked our way down. And every once in a while, we got an email from someone with one of the services saying, hey, can you compare this for us? Because we're doing a review, we'd like to know what everyone else is doing. So we jumped in a few out of order for that.
Wow.
Just to help people out. Yeah.
So what was the initial inspiration for you?
Mate,
I mean, you're studying one area, there's an area you're going to work in. What was the...
Yeah, it's... Look, honestly, I think I've been, broadly speaking, interested with it right back to my first uni days down in Victoria when I started uni with paramedicine. I had no idea that there was this book which I was essentially expected to memorize and apply throughout the next 3 years of my bachelor's, and that when I did my OSCEs each semester, I'd be assessed against whether or not I'd memorize this book. When I went out on placement, I routinely was asked to recite CPGs from memory. Hopefully that's a thing of the past for most people.
I was going to say, this is a whole nother podcast.
That happened to me a lot. And when I did well, they would say, you're a good paramedic. And when I couldn't remember them, they'd say, you're a bad paramedic. And that was a big part of my, upbringing in paramedicine. And I had a couple of particular instances. One which springs to mind was I just had to do a uni summit. It was first year, we were doing trauma, and one of the ones they wanted us to do, we were looking at TBIs. We had to compare guidelines from different states. That was the actual uni assignment. And I randomly happened to pick Queensland, where I've ended up, but that was unknown at the time. And it was for dealing with cerebrally irritated people, you've got someone who's had a bit of a knock to the head, maybe like a mild TBI, and they're a little bit agitated, and your de-escalation, you're wanting to look at some kind of pharmacology. What are your choices? And I remember seeing that down in AV, our guideline at the time certainly was that midazolam was contraindicated and that we were to give opioids. And then I'd looked at the Queensland guideline and it was the opposite.
The complete opposite.
Not. I mean, Queensland didn't contraindicate opioids, but they did have a specific indication for midazolam as a sedative of choice. And that was really fascinating to me. I didn't particularly care that there was a difference in the guidelines. What I wanted to know is what's the right thing to do for my patient. I just wanted to know why that is and what we're meant to do. And we had this tutor come in. He was an ICP. Down in Victoria, we call our ICPs MICA. It's just a different acronym because we never could agree on what to call ourselves in Australia. But we had this really senior helicopter paramedic come in. And I was so excited to talk to this guy. And you know what it's like when you're a first year uni student and you meet these guys who work up in that big loud thing in the sky and they're just like gods to you. And I'm sorry, that's basically you, Nick, isn't it?
No, not at all.
I tell you what, you look like a god. I can see you got the face of a Greek god.
He has never said that about me.
And I never will.
There's a market for everything, right?
And I went up to this guy and I said, hey, I've just been doing a bit of research. I found this. You know, why is it? And he cut me off before I'd even finished my question and said, don't talk to me about what they're doing in Queensland. They're killing their patients. And then he turned and walked off. And that's verbatim quote. And then I was really kind of, I guess, a little bit taken aback by that because, well, I mean, he hadn't answered my question. I still had no idea why there was the actual difference. But also just the sheer lack of curiosity, this culture of I'm right, you're wrong, of either you apply this blindly or you're a bad paramedic. It was just something which was right there from the start, which didn't feel right to me and which I now know from talking to way more experienced, knowledgeable people who are just ahead of me on the curve like yourselves is not how things should be, although I didn't know that as a first-year student at the time. And then there were a couple of more instances, which was cut forward a couple of years. I've been down in Victoria and my wife and I decided to move up to the beautiful Sunshine Coast in Queensland, which is where she's from, for family. And I started working with QAS, learning a new set of guidelines, and I was chatting to some other people who had recently had to change services. And one of them was this girl who'd moved also from Victoria to Queensland and who had accidentally used the maximum dose of intranasal fentanyl on a patient, and they'd given them the Victorian dose, which was 400 micrograms, rather than the Queensland dose, which was 200 micrograms. And sure enough, you know, the next day they got a call from their manager saying, what's going on here? You've overdosed this patient. You're giving them double what they should have had. That's, you know, a massive violation, blah, blah, blah. And she had to do like a little investigation and fill out a statutory declaration, all this kind of stuff. And in the end, it wasn't a big deal because the service said, it's okay, we understand why this happened. Just make sure you follow our book from now on. But it was really fascinating. I mean, double the dosage. That's the difference between on that particular thing at that point in time between those two states. And that definitely got me interested. And then the very last one was a few of my mates work for multiple services. And one of them, she works week on, week off, either for each service, either side of a state line, which is just a fascinating way to live your life. But the services, they cross over the state line and help each other out, which is just awesome, right? That's really good care for the patients. And but it did leave her in this weird situation where one week she attended the same patient with each service, and each time she had to give them completely different medications. And the patient was there going, what's going on? You saw me 2 days ago. Just give me the same thing you gave me last time. And she had to be like, well, look, this state and this state don't agree on...
I'm in a different uniform.
Exactly.
Wow.
Which was, for the patient, utterly baffling.
For the paramedic, equally.
How she walks around carrying two sets of guidelines in her head, I will never understand. Genuinely, I haven't got the brain for it. But anyway, all those things happened. I thought, man, I'm curious. And I started asking around. Other people were curious. Next thing you know, we had a team of 40 people, doctors, nurses, paramedics, all who just wanted to kind of catalogue the differences. So we're not really saying this is right and this is wrong. We're just saying, here's the things where we're doing different things. Let's have a think. Let's have a look. Let's get curious about it.
Here's a question. If there's so much variance between the different states, and there's probably variance if we go and look at how these patients are managed inside a hospital and other parts of the healthcare system, does that mean that we really don't know what is best for our patients yet?
That's a fantastic question. My personal opinion on that is, yes, we don't know what's best for our patient a lot of the time. There is one of the dark statements of paramedicine is there's little definitive empiric research in a lot of the things we do. And this actually, like I was talking to one of my mates who's an ED registrar, who works at a Lifeline now, and she was saying the same thing in medicine. You know, there's just massive fundamental parts of the medical practice that really just aren't backed up by strong evidence. And that goes into the pre-hospital setting as well. So having disagreements about how you should treat a patient in the absence of evidence is pretty reasonable. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. That's probably part of the picture there.
Mm-hmm.
A little thing in my head, though, keeps coming back to these statements that you hear people project or repeat, and it's things around evidence-based practice. We want to be an evidence-based clinician, and you're saying there's little empirical evidence around some of the things that we think we might understand, which would then translate to there's even less around the things that we don't understand.
Well, how many randomized control trials are there for adrenaline in anaphylaxis? Zero. I mean,
running any kind of an RCT for someone who's just called 000 because it's an emergency, I mean, that's just ethically, logistically a nightmare. It's such a hard thing to do. So I'm not surprised that there's not an enormous amount of them going on. But on the other hand, you know, in Australia, we're really well funded with our ambulance services. Our budget was $4.8 billion last year. We can definitely afford to do good, rigorous research comparing these things if we prioritised it. But it's just part of the culture of what we do is the services very, very fairly view meeting their operational demand as their job. That's what they're legislated to do. That's their mandate. And
is that measured appropriately, though?
Well, don't even get me into response.
Hole,
yeah, you know? Don't get response times are like, oh god. But so,
I digress.
I mean, what they should really be doing is, you know, Parliament should be saying to each ambulance service, well, look, can you give us evidence that your actual guidelines, that the treatment that you're giving is appropriate, rather than were you there quickly enough? But you know, that's all by the by. So
how did you even start? You said there were 40 people. Who you managed to put together. And I'm assuming this is a cross-section of people from, what, across the country?
Yeah, and international as well.
Oh, international is awesome. How did you even approach something like this then? Because obviously you've got to get access, and some of those are less accessible than others.
Yeah, look, back when we started it off, which again is a few years ago now, it was the initial plan, the initial vision was to do them all as formal academic papers, really rigorous, peer-reviewed, which we could then publish and would be, I guess, a concrete, citable thing that we could use to kind of advocate one way or the other. And then what ultimately happened was we did do that initially with the first three. We published an intro paper, and I think it was anaphylaxis and sepsis comparisons. And then AJP went on hiatus while it slowly transmutated into paramedicine, which was, a great thing for the journal and for paramedics across the world. But it was a real bummer for us because we were suddenly left adrift with this project we really wanted to do and no home for it. And we were looking for somewhere, and it seemed at that point there was a pretty strong vibe that the academic formal publication, it's quite a hard, tricky process to go through. And we weren't trying to determine what best treatment was. We just wanted to report on the differences. We just wanted to do that initial first step of give people the big picture. And I don't think you have to be an academic publication to do that. And so we started hunting around for journals, for trade magazines. And as luck would have it, you, Sonny, were there.
We're having another coffee, weren't we?
Yeah, to be our saviour at that point in time. And very, very graciously and kindly agreed to.
Well, it wasn't even gracious and kind. I think I had a conversation with Nick that lasted about 3.2 seconds, and I went, "Hey, mate, have a look at this poster." And Nick went, "Wow, this is an amazing comparison. We should get this going."
What you need to realize, Matt, was that Sonny was playing the long game when that first email about the research grant went out all those years ago.
Yeah, yeah. He's been like, "What can I milk this kid for?" I need content.
I need something done in the next 6 years.
But he needs content.
It still astounds me because this, I mean, I've been through the posters, you know, I've reviewed every single one multiple times, and I've used them in the classroom now, as well as I've also used them to reflect on my own practice, depending on where I'm practicing.
Me too.
Whole grey area of paramedic practice is the private sector. What we've essentially seen you do here with your team is review jurisdictional ambulance service guidelines, which give people clinical authority and access to things to do things. And when you move outside of that safety net and get into the private paramedic space, a lot of that just doesn't exist. So I've been really curiously digesting these myself, and it astounds me that you can put together something that would be deemed, or let's say, unacademic, but so rigorous in its process and so useful to question the very authorities that people are being given to practice out there.
I wonder what the review would look like if you went and compared some of the private sector services. Because a lot of these places do have CPGs. They're required to have CPGs of some description or drug therapy protocols to access some of their poisons licenses to carry scheduled drugs, especially some of the restricted drugs. So these things would exist out there across different parts of the private sector. So that would in itself would be fascinating.
I'll be controversial here, Nick, and I'll say a lot of the places that I have worked for, and I don't want to use the term stolen, borrowed, used.
Reinvented.
The language is almost identical in a different format. Mm. But a lot of the ambulance service CPGs have been borrowed, used, stolen from private companies because it's easier to reproduce something from
a source. And that happens within the services themselves. I mean, certainly Ambulance Victoria and Ambulance Tasmania, as far as I know, it's not no longer the case. But there's definitely a period in time where, AT is just resource-wise didn't have the capacity to produce these guidelines, but they wanted what was best for their patient. And Ambulance Victoria very kindly let them pay a nominal fee. I think it was like $2,000 a year or something. Nothing for a service of that size to use for the rights to use their guidelines, which they could then tinker with as they like. And one of the things which I found out now that I've spoken to some people who write guidelines, it's not everywhere, but in a lot of places, one of the first things you do when you're writing a guideline is look at what everyone else is doing. I mean, I would do that as well. I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think people should be criticized for that. But there's definitely a lot of that, borrowing from each other.
But that's reasonable, right? Like if an organization's gone and done a really rigorous examination of the best practice of medicine in the pre-hospital space or for a certain condition or then it's quite reasonable to say, well, what they're doing is good. Why reinvent the wheel?
Mate, I would go further than that. I would say it's somewhat wasteful to be doing the same thing eight times over, which is what we occasionally do end up doing in Australia.
Only if you can prove that it has been a rigorous process. And so, this kind of led me into another question here, Matt, is did you, through the course of this project, discover how the CPGs are put together? Because at the moment, we would make an assumption that there has been a rigorous process put behind it, and so therefore, why would we reproduce something identical? Why would we invest all the same money into it? It's kind of like when the US and Russia were both racing for the moon. If they had actually pooled their resources, they reckon they would have got there 10 years earlier and, a squillion dollars less. So I agree that if someone has done it well, why wouldn't we want to share, collaborate, and use it? But how are CPGs put together?
Yeah, this is something which I've come across a bit. Another fascinating point for me. The first thing I'd say is it's variable, massively, massively variable.
Like the CPGs themselves.
Yeah, like the CPGs themselves. And there's often good reasons for that. And in Australia, look, my general honest opinion is that in Australia we're very lucky. We have, broadly speaking, just guidelines that are phenomenal, often written by people with great expertise and experience, and we're able to give our patients just this really incredible standard of care. Some places in Australia, we don't have that ability at the moment, and certainly other places throughout the world I've seen have no guidelines or very, very little. Look, like I said, it's variable. A bad example, and this is an Australian example, was I spoke to the person who used to write the guidelines for one particular service, and that person very frankly told me that they just make them up off the top of my head. And that they sometimes jump on Google and quickly Google a topic to make sure they haven't missed anything big.
I feel like there's a lot just been said in a very short period of time. Sorry.
Well, let me give it a bit more context. That person is a professor of medicine.
Okay.
A very, very highly trained doctor.
Googling.
So, yeah, Googling things. That's a verbatim quote. But I read the guidelines and they're good. They look like they're doing the right thing from what I can tell from the outside. But it's not necessarily a great system. And that's really where my concern comes in.
How does the person who sits down and gets allocated the task of writing a CPG, like, let's say, hey, Sonny, I want you to look at all our cardiac CPGs or our trauma CPGs and just make sure we're doing best practice. With the amount of...
I'd probably Google.
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Chat GDP, treat chest pain. Obviously, there's a lot of research that happens throughout the world that gets published in different journals. Some of them are marketed or put out there for public access. Some of them are restricted. Some of them are in English. Some are in other languages. Like, there might be someone in Portugal doing a really good study of a treatment for a condition that never makes it to an English language journal, just as an example. How does the person who writes the CPGs stay on top of all the contemporary evidence that's out there to make sure that CPG is accurate?
Well, it's borderline impossible, isn't it? I mean, there was that famous article which every single man and their dog's heard of, where it's, 10,000 systematic reviews a year, how will we ever keep up, or something was the title of it. I can't quite remember. But that's an actual published article. Look, in a dream world, what I would love to see, and some services, again, are basically already doing this, others can't even get close, that's really where the problem lies, is I would like to see what we call living systematic reviews, where you basically do a systematic review process, and then rather at the end of it just closing the book and putting it to the side, you update that routinely. So every 3 months, you redo your literature search, see if new literature comes in, and if there is, you then incorporate it into the systematic review, and that allows you to stay up to date with what's going on. And I'm not, making this process up or anything. That's recommended by Cochrane, and it's and there's good methods and evidence for that. That's obviously quite labor-intensive, extremely labor-intensive, and difficult to do. The other thing that I would really like to see is that we actually have full-time staff who are doing this. Most of the places that I've spoken to rely pretty heavily on volunteers giving up their time to help write the guidelines. And that includes both the paramedics who kind of do that review of the literature and draft them, through to when they decide to send them out for a second opinion to a, professor blah, blah, blah. You're asking that, whoever they might be, that professor, whoever, to just quickly check in their own time, read this relatively complex document. You end up getting a response back at 1 o'clock in the morning where they've just said, yep, all good, and sent it off. Look, what we really need is to be paying people for their time, paying external people to come in, sit down with us and really go over them thoroughly and make sure that we're doing the right practice. I think the people who are writing guidelines as volunteers need training. Some of them, again, have great training and amazingly rigorous, strong backgrounds. Others do not. And I think as a baseline level, you should certainly be trained in systematic reviews, reviews of a synthesis of evidence, and definitely in guideline production, like the Agree To instrument. Those are, you can't, it's producing a medical guideline is an entire field in its own right. We shouldn't just assume that we're able to do it off the top of our heads. And I think the other thing that these people need is good access to resources. One of the funnier things that that came up when I was chatting to some people is that, I can't say for certain it's every service, but the vast, vast majority do not have subscriptions to any academic databases. So the articles they need are behind a paywall, and they don't have a budget to just pay for individual articles. So what do? Well, they end up finding volunteers who tend to be people who are doing their masters in, ICP or something like that. They ask them to volunteer on the guideline writing team, and then they get that person to just sneakily use their uni access. That's crazy. To me that a government department would essentially be stealing services from a uni. But that's, and frankly, I personally don't particularly care about that really that much. But it's really crazy to me that that's the system that we've ended up with, is one that relies on unpaid volunteers using access that they have elsewhere, sometimes with training, sometimes without. And this goes to something as unbelievably fundamental as the actual medicine that we deliver people. I mean, the amount of resources that we put into our availability and our operational capacity, that's all kind of a little bit hollow, a little bit silly, if then when you finally arrive at that person, you're doing something which is the incorrect treatment. the treatment is really so, so fundamental, the bedrock of everything that we do, that I would love to see guidelines that are just equally as rigorous. Anyway, it's my rant for the minute.
You make a valid point.
I'm glad someone thinks so.
It's amazing.
It's a multi-billion dollar business.
4.8 billion last year in Australia and 480 million in New Zealand.
Like, if you're a restaurant, right, and you made $100 million a year and you said, oh, can you write this recipe for me on your own time and can't look anything up because we can't afford the budget to...
That's such a great analogy. I love it. Yeah.
Just figure out the best carrot cake.
Yeah. So, look, I mean... Those are some of the problems. There's some of the ways that we would like to think it might ultimately end up. One of the things that those of us who are interested in guidelines like to dream about is, well, where do we go? Where do we end up? How do we get there? And I think one of the things which I just constantly hear mentioned around the sticks when I'm kicking around on my ambulance is national guidelines. I mention to people what I'm doing bits and bobs on, and they all say, oh, I can't wait for national guidelines. Look, there's pros and cons to national guidelines. I'm not sure you want compulsory national guidelines which get flatly applied across the state, because we...
Or across the country.
Yeah, sorry, across the country was what I actually meant to say, because we have a huge country, and we have tropical medicine in the north, we have metropolitan urban areas, we have deserts. You don't want a one-size-fits-all, because that's not the kind of patients we get. So what we really want is a good set of rigorous evidence-based guidelines which you can then tailor your local practice to. That's what I think the dream is for us.
Now, there are some CPGs, obviously, at the other end of the spectrum too, that are obviously produced from research, even though it's borrowed from, you know, someone else's login. all the way through to someone who's obviously, you know, spoken ill and said, oh, I actually just, it's my opinion and I've Googled it. I mean, it's a wide variety. What are some of the more, I don't want to use amusing. Have you got some of the differences there that you've uncovered? Some of the more defining differences that you've uncovered?
Oh, mate, I've got absolutely heaps listed here. Again, these are just the ambulance services in Australia and New Zealand. But look, I don't want to go too much down a path. I don't want to name and shame.
No, that's what I'm saying.
These services, and once you've met the people who are writing these guidelines, you'll understand they're incredibly smart, they're incredibly hardworking, and they're trying to just do an impossible job where they have tiny resources and are trying to do this huge thing. But there are some pretty funny little differences. Like, one of my favorites was in the ROSC one, one service in their guidelines said, once you get ROSC, do not rush. Another service, which I read immediately after, said, when you get ROSC, transport immediately and rapidly. I thought, isn't that interesting? Like, that's not even got to do with the medicine. It's just a completely different approach in how you're supposed to handle the entire situation. Some of them were really interesting. Like, I mean, autonomic dysreflexia, I've only actually been to that once in practice. But the treatment, when we start providing nitrates for treatment for that, in one service, it was above a systolic of 150, another 160, another 170, another 180. Another didn't have an objective systolic, but just had a relative rise of 20 above whatever that patient's normal is. These are all big differences. The dosage for GTN ranged from 300 micrograms to 800 micrograms. It's big differences. And, you know, some services have normal run-of-the-mill paramedics like myself providing cardiovision and pacing. Other places, most places, limited to ICPs, and some places don't have anyone performing it. There's big variations. One of the ones which is probably more topical is ketamine. There's a 50-50 split, which is why I really like this one. It's dead 50-50 split between the services that let all paramedics give ketamine and those that restrict it to ICPs. I'm in one of the places that doesn't give it. I've never given ketamine, and I've no idea whether I should be allowed to or not. But that's just really interesting difference across the services. So there's about a million of them, and we've actually summarized them at the end of this document. So you can just open it up, scroll to the back, and there's just a list of differences, which is pretty fun reading, in my opinion.
Right, this is it's an amazing resource. There's some, you know, staggering differences. There's too many for us to go through today during the podcast. But mate, all I can say is thanks for the work you've done here. I think it's going to cause a lot of questions. And it's going to change practice eventually.
It's a fantastic document. Thank you. Thank you to the team that put it together. And thank you to all those people out there that are spending their time writing CBGs and trying to help clinicians practice good medicine. So
they're good people and they're very smart and they're working hard, but man, I would like to see them better resourced.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks for coming on the show today, Matt. Sonny, it's always a pleasure.
Mate, that was awesome. I've still got the list here from Matt. I've got the special edition that I'm going through, and it's going to be a fair bit of late-night reading tonight.
So if you'd like to grab a copy of the Clinical Practice Guidelines Manifesto, you can head to our website, www.theshiftextension.org, and it's our latest publication in our industry journal. If you have any questions, qualms, or queries, or concerns, reach out to us. We're on Facebook, Instagram, or send us a message through the website. But until next time, see you later.